And if we could give a nice, warm Valley Group welcome to Quincy Wharf from Agora Hill. That would be
wonderful. Thanks, Uncle Jim. That was spectacular. Strange, but spectacular. I feel like I was just introduced at a comedy club, and now you guys have all been given the appropriate information to judge me appropriately. So there you have it. Thank you so much for having me. I'm pretty sure Tammy asked me to speak tonight. I'm not sure if she's here or not, but thank you, Tammy, for asking me. It's always an honor and a privilege to do this, no matter where it is, and especially when the commute is something like this. It's, you know, super easy. It's fantastic. I'm always appreciative when the commute is this easy, and happy to do it. I'm so grateful that some of my sponsees are here. I'm happy. I'm always happy to share time with them, even if it's just me talking. Sorry, just a little loopy right now. A little tired, but that's all right. Welcome to everybody who's new. Welcome to those, and congratulations to those of you that are celebrating milestones. I, too, just celebrated a milestone. I celebrated the 33 years of sobriety, which is so hard to understand considering I'm only 36 years old. I'm not really sure how that math works out, but, you know. It's all good. All comes out in the wash one way or another. But actually, I was 18 years old when I got sober for the second time. And, you know, and when I got here, I was beat up. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. That's what they used to say when I got sober. And, you know, I was done. And alcohol had its way with me, and it was my master, and I was done. And I'm super grateful for the fact that I was done. And I hope that you're done too, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I also wish you the greatest adventure of your life. I didn't know that that's what was going to happen to me when I got here. I was kind of thinking I would be here long enough to get everybody to calm down in my life, so that they could just, you know, mellow out and, you know, leave me alone and then go away. And then I would go back into my life and do whatever it is that I was going to do and go about my merry business. And I had no intention of staying here for the next 33 years, but here I am. And my life is better as a result of it. And I'm super grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous and all the people in it. I have a great life today, and it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I don't have everything that I want. I'm not the perfect person. I don't work the perfect program, but I do have a life beyond my wildest dreams, in the sense that I'm freer than I have ever been. I have more love and more appreciation for the people in my life than I've ever had in my life. And I'm super grateful, which is a word I couldn't even spell when I got here. And those are things that I didn't know that I wanted even when I got here. So I'm great. I'm happy about that. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. Doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it helped. And my father was an alcoholic, and he was the kind of guy who everybody wanted to hang out with. He was the kind of guy who was a lot of fun. He was he worked in the music business. Most of you are old enough to know what album covers are, so I don't have to explain those to you. But he designed album covers, and so he had a lot of really interesting and fun friends. And they came over and hung out with him all the time. And so it was supernatural at my house to see drunk, naked musicians running around my house at any given moment. And I didn't know that there was anything wrong with that. I thought everybody had drunk, naked people running around their house at any given moment. So that was just what it looked like at my house. So drinking and drugs was just as much a part of my life and as normal in my life as, you know, drinking water and eating Cheerios is in my kid's life, you know. And that was just the way it looked at our house. And it was a lot of fun at my house. My house was the party house, and everything started at our house. Everything ended at our house. People would come and stay at our house and stay for weeks. There were months at a time that I didn't sleep in my bedroom because somebody would come and stay at our house and be there for months at a time because for whatever reason. And, you know, I always ended up kicked out of my room and sleeping on the couch, and they would end up in my bedroom for months at a time. And that was just the way that it looked, you know. And my parents, so I thought, were happy and in love and the greatest people on the planet. And you know, and everything was built around drugs and alcohol. And I just didn't know that that wasn't normal. I don't really remember my first drink. When you grow up in an alcoholic home, that, you know, having your first drink is, you know, could have happened at any time. I have ripped memories of being on the floor in the studio with my father, you know, sucking on his, you know, scotch-soaked rocks that he would have just finished a scotch on the rocks in the studio. And I can remember what those that tasted like from a very, very early age. So I'm not really sure when my first drink was, but I do remember my first drunk. And I remember it like it was yesterday because it was a night that changed my life forever. And the reason it changed my life forever is because I went from thinking one way to thinking a very different way the next day. And the kid that I was before that night was this kid who was, you know, awkward and anxious and, toxically insecure and conflicted. And, you know, I was always felt like I was sweating and anxious on the inside. And I felt like everybody could see how I was vibrating all the time. Although apparently I always looked like I was as cool as a cucumber on the outside, but on the inside, I just felt like I was constantly vibrating and sweating and nervous. And, but on the outside, apparently I looked super cool, but on the inside, I was just on fire. And I have a cousin who's 8 years older than me, and, you know, like any typical older cousin, she loved to turn me on to stuff. You know, she taught me how to dye my hair and shave my head and tie my bondage pants and, you know, important things, you know, what kind of bands to like, you know, important stuff. And, she was graduating from high school and she invited me to a party at her house, and this night, you know, my toxic insecurity and anxiety was no different than any other night, and I walked up to this party and you know, I was just on fire on the inside, and I was, you know, just so afraid of what everybody was going to think of me. Was I funny enough? Was I cute enough? Did my butt look cute in these jeans? Like, I was just obsessed with what people were going to think of me, and I walked into this party, and it was all these older kids, right? All these kids who were taller than me. They all had bigger boobs than me. They all had long blonde hair. You know what I mean? They just looked different than me, and here I felt like this awkward, you know, weird-looking little kid, and I walked in, and they were sitting around a card table playing quarters, and I didn't want to look foolish, and I didn't want to make a fool of myself. So I sat down and started playing quarters with them like I'd been playing quarters all 10 years of my life, and started to drink with the big kids like I, you know, like I knew exactly what I was doing. And I started to drink. And as the alcohol started to go into my system, all of a sudden, everything got great, right? Everything started to get really funny, and everything started to get really relaxed, and everything started to get really fun, right? But the greatest part about that night was that for the first time in my life, all that craziness, all that conflict, all that insecurity, all that conflict that was going on underneath my skin got super quiet and disappeared, right? And that was the magic of alcohol for me. The magic of alcohol was that it all of a sudden, you know, made everything that was so loud on the inside disappear, right? And that was what it did for me, you know, from the very beginning. And, you know, did I become a daily drinker at the age of 10? No, absolutely not. But did I become obsessed with what do I have to do to make that happen again? And where do I have to go? And what do I have to do? You know, absolutely. And, because all of a sudden alcohol was going to be my solution. It was going to be my solution to how I felt. It was going to be my solution to being cool. It was going to be my solution to, you know, not feeling good enough, not being enough, not having any self-esteem, all of these things that I didn't know it was going to be my solution to. And, it was going to make all of that weirdness go away. And that was exactly what happened, you know. My father's alcoholism escalated, and as his alcoholism escalated and started to get really, really bad, you know, mine started to take off and become really super exciting, and I started to arrive in all kinds of places. I became a Hollywood club kid and started, you know, slipping out the window and, you know, hanging out in clubs in Hollywood all night long and drinking, hanging out with boys and doing drugs and having the time of my life, and starting to feel like I was somebody, starting to feel like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I was a whole different person and I was having a whole different life. And weird things started to happen to me. I started to, you know, wake up in places that I couldn't remember how I got there, and I was starting to behave in certain ways that I couldn't remember, you know, how those things started to happen or when those things started to happen. And I started to show up with people I didn't remember meeting, and all kinds of weird things started to happen, but I didn't care. You know, I didn't care because, you know, if I didn't remember how it happened or if I didn't remember what had happened, I wasn't responsible for it. That was always my motto, you know. And, but my dad's alcoholism got worse, and as a result of his alcoholism getting worse, you know, my mom started to put him into rehab and started chasing him in and out of rehab, and she started going to Al-Anon, and when she went to Al-Anon, they said, oh, do you have kids? And because we have a program for kids, and so they, she's, you know, they talked to her about Alateen, and she came home one night, and they said, you know, they have a program for you, and, you know, I want you to go to these Alateen meetings. And I remember thinking, are you out of your mind, lady? Like, the last thing I want to do is go sit in meetings and talk about you people. Like, nobody cares. Like, nobody cares about what's wrong with you people. I don't care. I don't even know who you people are, but I really don't care what's wrong with you, so I don't really want to talk about anything. But I lost that battle because I was 12, and I just remember thinking, like, if I have to go to this stupid meeting and talk about my parents, like, I'm just going to go as stoned as I can stand. And so I got as hammered as I could handle and got in the back of my mom's car, and we drove over the hill to Brentwood. And just, I just remember driving the whole way there thinking, oh, God, if I have to go to this stupid meeting, I'm not going to go. Like, there's no way I'm going to go. Like, I don't want to go sit in a room with a bunch of kids I don't know and talk about crap I don't want to talk about. So, like, I'll go for a walk. Like, I'll go sit in a bush. I'll go rob a liquor store. Like, I can find something to do. Like, I can, you know, make time to go do anything, but I'm not going to this meeting, you know. And so we pull up to this church in Brentwood, and I look out the window of the car, and I see the most beautiful boy I've ever seen in my entire life at that point, sitting in front of this church. And I got out of the car and I went to the meeting, and I went to Alateen religiously for like the next 7 years, right? Because Alateen, like AA, is a program of attraction rather than promotion. Like, we don't really care what attracts you here, just stay, right? And I have to tell you that, you know, that principle rings true today. Like, we don't really care what attracts you to AA, just stay, right? If it's a boy, if it's a girl, if it's both, whatever, just stay, right? And, you know, I've stayed for worse, I've stayed for less, whatever. And it was great. Like, we would go to these meetings and we would sit and talk about what a hot mess our parents were. And then, you know, we would go across the street to the liquor store and pimp booze and try what they tried. And it was great. Like, I did a lot of drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my mom was so obsessed with getting my father sober that she wasn't really paying attention to what I was doing. And so when I would say to her, yeah, I want to go to the SoCal convention down in San Diego with all my friends in Alateen, like, she saw absolutely nothing wrong with putting her 13-year-old daughter on the train with a couple $100 in her pocket by herself and sending her to San Diego to go spend the weekend in a hotel room with 16 other Alateens, right? Like, the fact that I ended up, like, drunk, butt-naked, covered in shaving cream at an AA convention shouldn't shock anybody in this room. Like, and if it does, you might be in the wrong room. But, like, that's just, like, what happens to people like us, you know, at that age with that kind of freedom, right? And so, you know, and that's what that's what booze looks like for me when it's working, right? Because, you know, for me, when I start to drink, I lose the power of choice over what's going to happen next. You know, you put a little bit of booze into my system and I just want more. You know, my friend Carl talks about it perfectly, right? He said, you know, you give me booze and it makes me thirsty, right? And he said, and I don't have that effect with everything. He's like, you can give me a bottle of water. He's like, and I'm not going to all of a sudden, like, go buy a case of water, lock myself in a hotel room and try to drown myself with it. Like, that's just not a thing, right? But with booze, I absolutely will try to do those things, you know? And that has always been the case for me. Like, I've never had just a little bit of alcohol. Like, I may think I can. Like, I may think, oh, yeah, I'm going to have one glass of something. Which, I mean, let's be clear. Like, at 13 and 14 and 15 years old, like, there's no such thing as social drinking. Like, we're not drinking for sociability. Like, we are drinking for the effect at that age. Like, that's just why you're doing it, right? So I've been drinking for the effect since the get-go. So, like, that's just always been my reason, right? And that's why I drank. So I don't even know what it means to drink socially, period. But that was always my reason. And the second it would get into my system, my body would just crave more of it anyway. And I had started to black out at a really young age. And that's a physical allergy. Like, that doesn't happen to normal people. Normal people don't have that reaction. Normal people don't drink so much that they start to lose consciousness. Like, that's not a thing for them, right? And I only know that because I actually been married to a normal person, and he doesn't even know what that, like, he doesn't even understand what that means. Like, he doesn't mean, he's like, what do you mean you would black out? Like, what does that look like? I'm like, well, if I could explain it to you, ding dong, I would, but I wasn't really there, so I don't know, you know? I don't remember, right? But, anyway, I started to black out at a young age, and, you know, that cousin that I hung out with, we did a lot of drinking together, actually, back in those days, and, you know, one of the last nights I drank, when I was 15 and a half years old, she and I went to a bar together, and, you could do that back in those days, and, we went out, and, you know, we went to this bar, and the next thing I knew, I was in the alley across the street from Grumman's Chinese Theater with my clothes torn and blood all over me, sleeping next to a bum, and I had no idea how I'd gotten there. And at 15 and a half years old, like, that's not normal behavior. Like, that's just not normal behavior. I mean, let's be clear, like, that's not normal behavior for a 40-year-old either. Like, that's not normal behavior for anybody. Like, I mean, let's just call that what it is. But that's definitely not normal behavior for a 15 and a half year old. And because I had been around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I kind of knew it wasn't normal, right? Because I'd been around just enough to, like, hear you guys talk about your stories and hear you guys talk about the consequences of your drinking. And I really believed that alcoholism was about consequences. I really believed that it was about what happened to us as a result of being in, you know, out there drinking. And so, you know, because I would go to meetings and I would listen to you guys tell stories. And I remember being in a meeting once and listening to this guy talk about being in the Navy and being so drunk that he tried to steal a battleship. And I remember thinking, well, God, I've never been so drunk that I tried to steal a battleship, so I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic because I've never done that, right? So I'm not really an alcoholic. And then I'd go to a meeting like a week later and I'd hear some woman talking about being so drunk that, you know, she slept with her, you know, best friend's husband or boyfriend. I'm like, well, I've done that twice this week, so I must be an alcoholic this week. So I was always looking for, you know, the right consequences to make me an alcoholic because I didn't understand what it meant to be an alcoholic, you know? And I was so afraid to ask questions when I got here because I was so afraid of looking stupid that I just thought I could, you know, figure it out by listening to you guys enough, you know. So the first time I got sober, I was 15 and a half years old, and I got sober and I stayed sober for a while. But I got sober on the idea that if I just put the drugs and the alcohol down, that I would be okay. Because I really believed that this was about drugs and alcohol. And let's be clear, like, there's a big part of this that is about drugs and alcohol. I have a physical allergy to alcohol. I have a physical addiction that happens when you put drugs and alcohol in my body. You put it in my body, I crave more. There's a phenomenon of craving that happens in our type that doesn't happen in other people. I get thirstier. I want more. I will go to any lengths to have more. I don't care. That's what makes me alcoholic physically, right? So there is that part of it. But alcohol was my solution. Right. And eventually my solution became my problem. And I didn't know that that was what was happening. Right. And so when you take my solution away and you don't replace that solution with another solution, then all of a sudden all those problems came up that I was using the first solution to solve. What do I have left, right? I have all those problems that came up the first time, right? So all that toxic insecurity and all that conflict and all that, you know, anxiety and all that emotional immaturity comes rushing back to the surface, and I don't have another solution, right? I don't have drugs. I don't have alcohol. So I'm just lying and cheating and thieving and, you know, doing all kinds of crazy stuff, making all kinds of more conflict because I don't have another solution, you know? And I'm just thinking sobriety is enough. Like, I'm going to meetings. I'm talking to people, but I'm not willing to read the big book because some old white guy like Jim wrote the book. And what do me and Jim have in common? He's some old white guy, for crying out loud. Like, what do me and him have in common? Nothing, right? And so I'm not going to read the big book, right? And I'm not going to talk to some old white guy like Jim because we couldn't possibly have anything in common, right? And I'm so busy thinking that I know what alcoholism is because I think it's about you guys' stories and I can relate to your stories, right? And I don't want to look stupid, not realizing that not asking questions is what's making me look stupid, right? So apparently my dog's bark collar isn't working, just so we're clear. But so I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable, I'm conflicted, I'm emotionally immature, and I don't have a solution in sobriety, right? And I don't know if you're anything like me, eventually if I don't have a new solution, right, to deal with all these problems, I'm going to go back to the solution that I know, right? Eventually it's going to be so uncomfortable for me to be me that I'm going to go back to the solution that I know. And that's what happened. You know, I stayed sober for almost 2 years, and I did, you know, the easiest thing you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is cop a resentment at somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous and then build a case about why y'all are crazy and y'all are drama queens and gossip mongers and I don't need to be here because you all are the problem, not me. And I left Alcoholics Anonymous. Within 20 minutes of walking away from Alcoholics Anonymous, I built a case about why I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. I mean, I wasn't even legally old enough to drink, so how could I be an alcoholic, right? And, you know, and alcoholism is a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease. You know, I didn't pick up where I left off. I picked up where I was, right? And I went from blacking out here and there once in a while to blacking out for almost the entire time I was out there. Because, you know, anybody who's here, not that I can see most people who are here, but anybody who's here, you know, who's ever been sober and then gone out and come back knows how hard it is to drink with a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. Like, that's the worst feeling in the whole wide world. Like, there's nothing worse than trying to get drunk with all those happy, shiny AA people in your head. Like, that's the worst, right? You got to drink a tremendous amount of booze to make all those people go away, you know? And I did. And I drank a lot. And I don't have to remember, you know, what I was willing to do or what I did in order to drink that much. I don't have to remember what I did to demoralize myself incomprehensibly in, you know, my drunken days. Because I've done that stuff sober, too. So I can only imagine what I've done, you know, drunk. You know, but when I came to on February 1st of 1988, all I know is I was pissed, right? I was pissed. I was pissed I wasn't dead. I was pissed I couldn't stay drunk. I wasn't trying to get sober. You know, I just came to on that day and I said a prayer that I believe every alcoholic says at one point or another. And that prayer was, help me. Now, I don't know who I said that prayer to because I didn't grow up in a religious family. I asked my father when I was 5 who God was. He said he was. That was the end of my religious upbringing. Like, that was all the schooling I had, right? So I don't really know where that prayer came from other than the fact that I was exhausted. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, you know, and I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for being so tired of just being so tired, you know, because I just I couldn't do it anymore, you know. I detoxed for a couple of days, and then my mom, being the wonderful, beautiful Al-Anon that she was, finally kicked down my door and sent me to a meeting, and, you know, and I just remember thinking, oh, no, not those people again. Not those people, you know. But if you're anything like me, I can't stand my own company. And so I put on my best outfit and went to, you know, whatever meeting I could find. And somehow y'all knew I was new. Not sure if it was the bikini top or the Daisy Dukes I was wearing or the candies I was wearing, but y'all knew I was new, and you were super nice to me, and thank God for that. You know, one of the things about Zoom that's so important right now is that we welcome each other, that we make each other notice, you know, that we recognize that Ashley's here, that Shelley's here, that Jennifer's here, that Jeremy's here, that, you know, Megan's here, that people know that we see them, that we recognize that each other's here, because, you know, if we don't recognize that each other's here, then we just become hollow. You know, and it's harder now than ever for us to feel like we're a part of a room, right? And when I first got here, thank God people walked up to me and they're like, hey. And I would walk into the rooms when I thought I was invisible and they'd be like, hey, Quince, what's up? So glad you're here. And I'd be like, you can see me? Like, I can't believe you can see me, you know? And like, I was so grateful when I, you know, I mean, I really thought I was invisible forever. And I bet there's so many people here that are like super happy to think that they're invisible because they don't have their screens on. You know what I mean? But the truth is it's, you know, we need to recognize each other. We need to greet each other. You know, Izzy, my sponsee who's here, she was the greeter at our Thursday night meeting for a long time. And, you know, she was the best greeter in town. She made sure everybody knew that they were welcomed at our meeting. And that was a big deal, you know. And it was a big deal when I first got here, you know. And it's a big deal still. It's still a big deal that we all know that we're here, that we all see each other, right? Because nobody needs to be seen more than an alcoholic. Nobody needs to be seen more than an alcoholic. Like, we need to know that we see each other, you know, and regularly. Like, we need to be recognized, and it's important, you know, and now more than ever, especially on Zoom. And because that's what kept me coming back here, because I was like, oh, wait, maybe somebody does care if I'm living. Maybe somebody does care if I actually breathe another day, you know, because I didn't care, and I didn't want to be here, and I didn't know how to survive, and I was glad that somebody cared. But they invited me to meetings, and I was lucky to land in a group of people that were all the same age as me, and they dragged me from meeting to meeting, and dance at the Platonic Temple to Platonic Temple, and we went to coffee where you could drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and eat food all indoors, all at the same time. Remember those days, Israel? Like, that was back in the day, you know? That was a long time ago. It's going to feel like forever now, you know? But those were the days, and we would stay up all night, you know? We used to have insomnia when I got sober. I don't know if they have that anymore. I think they've gotten rid of insomnia these days, but we had insomnia when I got sober, and we would stay up all night long for days, it felt like, you know? And we would stay up together, and we would just go to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, you know? But again, I got here believing that this was just about staying sober. I didn't understand that there was a huge difference between physical sobriety and mental, emotional, and spiritual recovery. I didn't know there was a difference, you know, just didn't know, you know, and I didn't want to know, right? Because I was all about half measures, right? I just wanted to do just enough to be comfortable. And the truth is I spent the first 13 years just going to meetings and making a mess, going to meetings and making a mess, going to meetings and making a mess. Like, that was what I was good at. Right? Because you can pull geographics in AA and just change meetings, just change groups and never see those people ever again and never get loaded, right? Like, some people are dumb and just get loaded, but, like, you know, I had a bigger ego than that. Like, I never wanted anybody to have a bigger sobriety date than me, so I wouldn't get loaded. I would just change groups. Right? I would just change home groups or just change areas that I was in, you know? But I stayed sober through a lot of stuff. And I never really got a sponsor because I never really understood what having a sponsor was. Like, people would say, get a sponsor, but I didn't know what you did with it. You know, what do you do? Dress it up? Put it on your bed? Like, what do you do with a sponsor? I would get these sponsors who would give me their phone number and say, yeah, call me when you need me. And I'd be like, well, I'm never going to need you, so I'm never going to call. Like, what does that mean, call me when you need? I don't need nobody. Like, what do you mean, call me when you need me? You know, that's just not never going to happen, so don't worry about it, right? And I did. I spent the first 13 years doing Alcoholics Anonymous my way, you know, and I was as dry as you can get. And it wasn't until I was 13 years sober that I was one more time building a case against Alcoholics Anonymous and about why I didn't want to be here, right? Because you have to remember, like, alcohol was my solution, and I had not replaced my solution. The only thing I had replaced was the way I kept myself busy, right? I stopped going to bars and started going to meetings. So all I had done is changed the way I occupied my time. I hadn't changed the way I resolved conflict. So I still had all this conflict, and the only way I resolved conflict was to pull geographics. I pulled geographics in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I still made just as much of a mess, but I would just move around in Alcoholics Anonymous when the conflict got too bad and start it over somewhere else all over again. Because I'm real good at starting over again, right? But I didn't replace my solution. I didn't replace the alcohol solution with a spiritual solution, right? So I was still practicing alcoholism without the alcohol in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Which happens a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way. This is not a unique story, unfortunately, right? So by the time I was 13 years sober, I'm as dry as you can get. I'm practicing alcoholism without alcohol in Alcoholics Anonymous, not even knowing that that's what I'm doing. And I didn't know that that's what I was doing until I walked into a big book study by accident. Because God only knows, nobody goes to big book studies because hot guys don't go to big book studies. So why on earth would I go to a big book study? But I only went there because apparently the woman who was my sponsor went to that meeting and I needed to ask her a question. And so I went to this meeting and it was the last meeting I was ever going to go to. And they were reading the big book and they were reading Two Wives, actually. And I was in a relationship with a practicing alcoholic at the time, and it was exactly what I wanted to hear. And it was the first time I had actually ever really heard recovery in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was blown away. And the man who was leading the meeting that night was a crusty old-timer like Jim. Oh, actually, his name was Jim, come to think of it, right? And he called on me, and he was like, hey, you, Happy Pants, you share. He had just read 5 pages in the big book, right? And he was like, you share. And I vomited all over this meeting about how much I hated Alcoholics Anonymous and I hate you people and I don't want to be here. Blah, blah, blah. And this is blah, this, blah, blah, blah. You know, just gross, right? And at the end of the meeting, this other old timer walked up to me and he put his hand on my arm. Ray J walked up to me and put his hand on my arm. And he said, Quincy, he said, AA is full of sick people. He said, do not expect them to act well. And I knew in that moment that not only was he talking about you, but he was talking about me. You know, I had been walking around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous carrying the disease of alcoholism, not even realizing that that's what I had been doing. And in that moment, not only did he give me permission to be sick in my own way, but he gave me permission to not be perfect in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I came here thinking that I had to know how this worked because I had been around for so long. I thought because I'd been around for so long that I was really pigeonholed into not asking questions, that I was really pigeonholed into having to know what was going on here, that I should have known better. I was 13 years sober. I should have known better. I should have had the answers. I should have been in a better spot. Like, we all have this, like, you know, I'm 13 years sober. I should be farther along than this. You know, everybody at some point in their sobriety says, I should be in a better place than this, right? Everybody says that at some point in their sobriety. When the truth is that we're all exactly where we're supposed to be in the moment that we're in it, right? But at some point, we all think that we're supposed to be in a different place, you know? We're supposed to be better than we are because of how much time we have. And it's just not true, right? But the next person that walked up to me was the craziest, scariest person I've ever met in my life. And she was crazy scary because she was the kind of person whose whole deportment shouted that she had a real answer. And I don't know about you, but I spent my whole life staying away from people with a real answer because I never really wanted one, right? I never really wanted one because I always thought I had one, right? I really did, you know? And so she walked right up to me and she shoved her card in my hand and she said, Quincy, she said, I'm really good at column work. And if you want to get free of those resentments, I can help you. And I remember thinking, what resentments is she talking about? Like, I was so clueless about how out of my mind I was. I didn't even know what she was talking about, you know. But I called that crazy, scary lady, and, you know, she gave me some directions. She said, I just want you to do the first two columns. And so I wrote down the first two columns of all the people in AA that I hated and why I hated them. And then I went to her house, and she busted out the big book, and she took me through the column work as she understood it, you know, in the big book. And this is usually where I put in my 30-second commercial about there's really no wrong way to do Alcoholics Anonymous other than to not do it, You know, every person in this room and in every room in Alcoholics Anonymous will go through the big book, will go through the steps, will go through everything with a completely different interpretation, with a different understanding, with a different experience, and through different eyes. And every one of those ways will be right. Because every attempt is a proper way to go through it. Everybody's right. My only caveat to that is that if you have gone through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you have not received the level of freedom that the promises, that the 12 steps promise, then just ask somebody else to take you through until you get there. That's it, right? Because it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, right? The spiritual awakening is a shift in perception. If you haven't had a shift in perception after you went through the steps, just ask somebody else to take you through until you have that shift in perception. Because that shift in perception is just freedom. That's what the shift in perception is, right? And you may have to go through the steps with 85 different people to get to that perception. Right, Kathy? You may have to do it with 85 different people just to have a little bit of freedom. Right? But it takes what it takes, right? It just takes what it takes. Kathy knows exactly what I'm talking about. Right? So just do it, right? There's no wrong way other than to not do it. That's the only wrong way to do it, you know? I hate it when speakers get up at podiums or get up in meetings and say, if you're not doing it this way, and if you're not doing it like this, you're doing it wrong. You know, you will kill alcoholics if you tell them they are doing this wrong. And I've been that asshole at the front of the room. You know, and part of my amends process is to make sure people know the only wrong way to do this is to not do this. You know, the only mistake you can make is to not give yourself a chance and go through the process. You know, just do it. Don't cheat yourself of going through the process, you know. I asked that lady to be my sponsor. It was kind of like asking her to marry me. It was so scary. And will you be my sponsor? It was the scariest question I've ever asked anybody in my whole life. And she was like, oh yeah, I'll be your sponsor. Like, she was so excited. She looked like she was going to eat me. Kind of scared me. And she said, but I have some requirements. And I said, oh God. Okay, and in my head I'm thinking, yeah, I got some requirements too, that you have no requirements. And I said, okay, what are they? And I was only willing to listen because I was dying. I was dying at 13 years sober, and I was as willing as the dying could be. And I said, what are they? She said, well, she said, I need you to call me every day for 30 days, and a minimum of once a week thereafter. And I said, okay, I go, that makes sense. You know, I can do that, right? Can you be surprised how hard it is to call somebody every day for 30 days? You know, people think that's easy. It sounds easy, right? You try it. Call somebody every day for 30 days. That's not easy, you know? And if I missed a day, I had to call her. I had to start all over again, right? I only missed one day. I only had to start over one time, right? Because that's right? She said, I need you to go to a minimum of three meetings a week. She said, anything less than three meetings a week, she said, you're a visitor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need you to be a member. And she said, and one of those meetings needs to be a meeting that I go to. She said, because if I don't see you, I don't know you, I can't help you. That makes perfect sense, right? I remember, you know, Izzy lives in New York, and Izzy asked me to sponsor her, and this was before Zoom, and I was like, I can't sponsor you. You live in New York. Like, I'm never going to see you. Boom, COVID hits. I'm like, oh, shit. Okay, well, there's a whole new ball game happening, you know. And thank God, because she's great, you know. And it's been a miracle for her that I get to sponsor her. Oh, just kidding. She said, you know, I have a sponsees meeting at my house once a month. She said, she said, I need you to show up for that. I remember thinking, oh, God, okay, sure. You know, because at this point, I'm willing to do anything, right? She said, but Quincy, this next thing might kill you. I was like, oh, bring it, right? And you have to remember, like, when I got to Linda, like, you know, I was tore up from the floor up when I got to Linda. She said, well, Quincy, she said, whenever you are in front of the room, whether you are giving a cake, taking a cake, leading a meeting, speaking in a meeting, whatever it is, she said, I require that you wear a skirt or a dress. And I remember thinking, where does it say that in the big book, right? And today I know where it says it, right? One of the places it says it is at the end of the ninth step. It says, remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths to stay sober. Right? And if she says, wear a dress, I wear a dress, right? And I remember being so pissed about that. Oh, I was so mad for so long about that. And she would just laugh at me, and she finally got sick and tired of listening to me bitch about it. And she said, you just don't understand why I asked you that, do you? And I said, no, because I'm thick also. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And she said, Quincy, she said, the easiest thing I'm ever going to ask you to do is to put your feet into a dress and zip it up. She said, that's the easiest thing I'm ever going to ask you to do. And she said, if you're not willing to do that once a week, twice a week, maybe three times a week, right? She said, if you're not going to be willing to do that, she said, you're not going to be willing to do anything else, and you're not going to waste my time. And she turned around and walked away. And I was like, huh, look at that, right? Now I know Israel and Bill and Jim are sitting here wondering if they have to wear a dress to recover. The answer is yes. Yes, you do. Come on, Bill. You know you want to wear a dress. It actually has nothing to do with the dress, and it has everything to do with being willing to do the stuff I don't want to do. Like, let's be clear. Like, the most convenient thing about tonight has been about signing on to Zoom. Like, it doesn't get any more convenient to go to meetings than going to Zoom, right? But there's still nothing convenient about putting on, you know, brushing my hair, wearing a bra, putting on a dress. Like, none of this is convenient for me. Like, having to talk, like, none of that's convenient, right? It's not convenient, but it's not always stuff I want to do. But I know that when I suit up and I show up and I do it, I always feel better at the end of it. You know, if I do the stuff that I don't want to do, my life gets huge in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I only do the stuff that I want to do, my life gets about this big, you know? And when my life is this big, the only person I'm thinking about is me. The only person, you know, that I care about is me. And I'm drunk in no time at all, you know? And that's just what happens for somebody like me. You know, the big book is all full of directions. Really only two directions. Really, really only two directions. You're either walking towards God or you're walking towards a drink. That's it. Those are your only two directions in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and am I willing to be inconvenienced? Am I willing to do the stuff I don't want to do? Am I willing to be of service to somebody else? Am I willing to practice, you know, love, tolerance, kindness, all of the things that it talks about in the big book? Or am I willing to just do me? Just do me, just only do what I want to do, you know, just be inconvenient, you know, just do what Quincy wants, you know, because if that's what I want to do, then I'll be drunk in no time, you know. And that's what the big book talks about, you know. This whole program is not so much about not drinking, although that's pretty much required if I want to get a new solution, but it's really about replacing my old solution, which was drinking and using, for a new solution. That's all it is, right? And if my new solution is to be the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, it means practicing it in all my affairs. And all of my affairs means every day, all the time. And that's not easy to do, you know. I have a good life today. You know, I'm free 90% of the time. That's way bigger than anything I ever would have imagined, you know. I'll say three things and shut up. Linda told me that I'm responsible for three things. I'm responsible for my happiness. If I am disturbed, it's a spiritual axiom that I have a part, right? So I better figure out what my part is so I can get free. She said, I am responsible for my recovery. She said, I may be your sponsor. She said, but if you want what I have, you better chase me like I owe you money. And she said, you better come get it. She said, because you can't get it any other way. And she said, you are responsible for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. She goes, nobody cares about how successful you are in your life. They only care about whether or not you have achieved freedom as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And hopefully that's what I've demonstrated. So thanks for listening.
Thank you. Can we have a round of applause for our speaker?